Welcome, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Enabling Digital, the Systems Plus podcast series. Today, we're going to focus on women in tech, and therefore, it gives me immense pleasure to welcome Dr. Parvez Khan. She's the Director General and CEO of SMR. Dr. Khan is an insight leader with a strong track record of transforming research functions into insight powerhouses. With a strong passion for bringing data to life, delivering high-quality outputs, driving up team performance, and engaging with stakeholders, she's able to effectively create actionable insights needed to drive business growth for the world's leading companies. Dr. Khan, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure.
Fantastic. So let's dive right into it.
Sure.
I read about your journey of how you grew up in a poor immigrant community in the UK, with very no major scope for a strong career, et cetera. But you sort of gotten through that. You've broken the glass ceiling, et cetera. So tell us a little bit about your journey. And also, you know, I found, you know, while I was reading a little bit more about you and going through some of your other recordings, et cetera, you always had this passion for analyzing and interpreting data, and that's sort of what got you to where you are. So I just love to learn more about that, and our listeners would love to sort of hear more about that, especially the women who are trying to make, trying to break through that glass ceiling.
Absolutely. I mean, the qualities that you need in my profession, which is all about really analyzing data, is a deep curiosity. You know, you'd need to be so inquisitive. And I've always had that as a child. I was always curious about everything, about how the world worked, how people worked. And my original passion was, of course, to become a lawyer, if you have read my background. And but poor kids like me just didn't do law. I mean, we didn't have the privilege of a middle class family and the resources to go and study law. But I had this sort of fire in my belly always that I wanted to do something really purposeful in my life. And so contrary to expectations, I did go and do really well in high school, and I did really well with my qualifications. And I then went on to university, and I got a grant from the government, so which paid for my university, my tuition, my living expenses. And then I managed to be fortunate enough to get a PhD and really study human behavior in more detail. I mean, that was something that really drove me, trying to understand why people behave the way they did. In that context, it was all about political decision making, I was looking at the creation of the European Union back in the 1990s and how the issues of national sovereignty played out in discourse, and how nationalism was almost being overtaken by very xenophobic and almost racist type of language around the time, which interestingly is always topical, isn't it? There's always issues around refugees and immigrants and how they're coming over, and recently in the UK we've had some awful language about being swamped by an influx of refugees, which is complete and utter rubbish, but it's very damaging, type of narrative. Right. Well, anyway, to cut a story short, I ended up going to work for a number of big brands. And I've always, always, Sunak, had a deep fascination with technology. Technology, at the end of the day, is responsible for really accelerating the pace of change in our lives. And it touches every aspect of our lives, the way we work, the way we live, the way we socialize. It's quite remarkable. And in my own industry, data, research, insights, we look at market and customer research and data analytics, and we use that to help businesses better understand their consumers and their would-be customers. Mm-hmm. We've really seen a radical transformation just over the last decade in how we gather, store, and analyze data, and how we better understand customer experiences, behaviors, and actions. And the key driver of that has been data processing technologies and data text and data web mining technologies, which of course continue to advance with artificial intelligence-based engines and cloud computing. And, I'd be remiss not to talk about the power of generative and conversational AI tools like ChatGPT, which everybody is talking about right now. I mean, for our industry, it's a real game changer.
Right.
Now, whilst I'm in awe of these technologies, and I really appreciate the power they provide and how it can really help us streamline processes and really get to understand customers in a more agile and much faster speed, there's a big but, you know, and that is I've also seen how the value that we can leverage from these amazing technologies, you know, it can be really limited if we don't also apply on the enormous effort that's needed to work on the data itself. Yeah, because data can't speak for itself. And what I've experienced in my sort of last decade particularly is that we've become really great at mining data. And we've, you know, we use tons of metrics, we have fabulous dashboards, but we've actually got poorer at analyzing what all of that data means. And I always say to people, the challenge isn't being data driven. The challenge is being insight driven. Because with insight, you have to interpret that data in a really meaningful way. You kind of need to speak for the facts. And that means you have to, you know, have a business head. You need to apply that business acumen and wrap up that understanding of that data into commercially framed options and recommendations to help your company grow, your stakeholder grow if you're on the agency side. Now, that's the tough part. And I think that's where professionals like me come into play. You know, we're like data translators. We right. help companies really understand their data better. And we use technology as an enabler. But technology itself can't replace that need for human judgment and human interpretation.
Absolutely. And you're absolutely right. And you touched on ChatGPT, and I know you have done multiple talks around the metaverse. You know, this is now the bleeding edge of technology. In your opinion, what are sort of the parallels that you can draw in terms of what we saw, you know, about 20 years ago and how technology was changing and the whole dot-com bubble into moving into what we are seeing today between the ChatGPT and the metaverse in terms of how that's transforming the tech industry? And also what role the whole data aspect has to play into that? Because as you said, data on its own can't speak for itself. But somebody needs to be able to explain it. But these new sort of ways of the future, you know, it's becoming more and more difficult to figure out who's speaking.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there are a couple of things to unravel here. First of all, there's the regulatory sort of framework. I mean, we want ethical, responsible technologies, and we need regulation to make sure that's happening, that consumers are not being exploited in any way and that data isn't being gated in a way that only the big business has access to the data and others are somehow disenfranchised or marginalised because they don't have access. So, you know, and that reduces competitivity, for example. So we need to create these level playing fields. Now, that's an interesting story about data, regulation, sorry, because things like GDPR was really created for filing cabinets. You know, it wasn't really designed for the internet and it certainly wasn't designed for social media. And it's always been on the back foot. Regulation has always been on the back foot, Sunuk. And it can't keep up with the pace of change. You know, these technologies, ChatGPT, I mean, what? I mean, that took like 6 months to produce. Right. Technology is always going to, you know, outrun, you know, the regulation. So this is where we need to ensure that there's an element of self-regulation in the industry. We need developers, creators to create some kind of code of ethics themselves that they're adhering to so that we can trust them, that we can trust their intent, and we can also trust the veracity of the data they're using to train their large language models. So that trust piece is a huge issue right now. Mm-hmm. I would love it to be regulated, for example, because I represent SMR. We're an industry association, of course. We want good regulation, but we don't want regulation to stifle innovation either.
Right.
So it's striking that balance, and that's not easy. So maybe self-regulation is the way to go. But some people will argue that that won't be enough, because many companies out there will be looking to make a profit, and that's going to be their main driver. So there's a conversation to be had about regulation. The other conversation to be had is every time there's a new AI application out there, there is a conversation about whether it's going to displace jobs.
Right.
We've been here many times before. You know, is automation going to replace jobs? And in many ways, it has. I mean, in many ways, these new enterprise level data systems mean that we don't need as many business intelligence analysts, for example. Mm-hmm. We can now automate that. You know, we can simply buy an enterprise solution, can do that work for us. Likewise, with ChatGPT, given that it can create great content and do a lot of that discovery research, you can even do segmentation for you. It can help you develop a brand strategy. I mean, it's endless, the things it can do. It is inevitably going to have an impact on the creative industry, the data analytics industry, the market and consumer research industry, inevitably. So like, it's going to happen. Now, some people predict within 10 years, we're going to see a 50% reduction in the workforce. Others will go so far to say it's going to happen within 5 years. And that's a conversation that industry bodies like SMR need to have. We need to really understand the implications on our jobs. It could be that it creates new types of jobs that we now have the ability to invest more time on the creative aspects of our discipline rather than doing all the sort of boring, you know, sort of desktop research, which we can get an AI bot to do. We can focus more on, well, what is this research telling me? How can I help my client get that competitive advantage? Because now I'm freed up. I have more time to think about the analysis side of the data rather than focusing on just curating all that information, because that takes time in itself. So these are some of the really complex, really difficult, challenging issues that we're facing right now.
Right. And of course, there's no clear answer. But if you look at any sort of a trend, historical trend, usually, you know, technology or any innovation displaces something, but it creates more jobs or more opportunity, etc. Is that sort of how it's been?
Yeah, or it creates new types of jobs. And the issue is reskilling or upskilling people who have been displaced into mm-hmm. these new jobs, and whether that's easy, you know, because otherwise that's where you get those disparities emerge in society. Where those people simply cannot find new roles that they can do.
Absolutely. Speaking of SMR, actually, I'd love to understand a little bit about how you sort of got there and the challenges you face as a woman how sort of, you know, taking on that role itself.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Well, I mean, it's actually nearly a year. I mean, it'd be a year in July that I've been at the helm of SMR. And it's been, look, a fast learning curve. I'm not going to lie. It's been one of those sort of situations in life. It's trial and error. You know, you sort of been thrown into the deep end. But it was a challenge that I was very much willing to take. Now we don't do research. We represent the industry, so we represent the companies and the professionals that make up the industry. We have something like 750 companies, 12,000 subscribed members. But when we add up all the people who we're engaging with on a regular basis, we're talking about, you know, 40,000 or more professionals. Wow. And we represent an industry worth $120 billion. dollars. I mean, it's a big industry and it's growing exponentially. And right. we provide things like training, events, professional networking for our members. Now, what I've been doing since I've been here is I've really been harnessing technology to build a really operationally resilient SMR. You know, I think it's really critical that mm-hmm. we strengthen our digital backbone so that we are ourselves able to be more nimble, more efficient, more agile. And I've done that by, you know, using a lot of new technologies and working with new providers in the field to help us develop our own tech stack. You know, I've just been recently looking at our CRM system, making sure that we're really capturing data across all our customer touch points. And the other thing I really want to do, Sunuk, is look at all these new emerging disciplines in our industry. We're now increasingly seeing more data scientists who need to learn storytelling skills, who need to be right. able to do great visualization of all of that data, and who need to create a narrative that their stakeholders really understand. And they're looking for training. They're looking for a platform that's going to help them do that. And that's the kind of thing that SMR does. So we certainly want to, embrace these new verticals that we describe them as new verticals that are sort of emerging in our sector, because we're no longer that traditional market research space we were 75 years ago when we first launched. You know, these days it's all about MarTech, so we call that marketing technology. It's yes. all about research tech, mm-hmm. And you know, it's all about data as a service. So we're really working hard, or at least I'm working really hard, to bring these new companies into the SMR family. And I'm really wanting to also showcase how data and data analytics is helping to solve humanitarian issues around the world, like poverty, health, human rights, climate change, education. You know, if you take digital skills, for example, in a country like Kenya, where we recently been working on, and we've got a leadership summit coming up in July, is we are looking at how data can be used to really flag the disparities we're seeing in digital skills between men and women and girls. And Kenya, particularly Nairobi, is Savannah, you know, Silicon, their Silicon version of the tech hubs. You know, Nairobi is really growing, but it has an acute shortage of digital skills like cybersecurity, for example, and women are getting left behind. And so we're really looking at drawing on our profession to map the skill needs of today and the future in a country like Kenya. And we're sort of working with data and research companies there to showcase the fantastic work they're doing. So those are some of the initiatives I'm involved in. But one thing I should add is, no leader is an island. You know, you need a team. You need a smart team who've got the abilities mm-hmm. to support you, but also who have the same desires and the same drive as you. You know, you need that team. So one of the things I've been really doing is, you know, getting that team on board and developing those mutual goals and making sure that they're on the same journey with me and taking ownership for those goals, and that they have the tools and resources to set them up for success. And that's been a key focus of mine as well.
That's fantastic. Also, I'm glad you brought up the whole gender diversity issues and the gaps fundamentally in Nairobi you were talking, but I know you've seen things globally. Do you see the gap, gap in tech, especially wider developing countries, or is it you see across the board? And sort of what are your thoughts on how to address them? How can companies yeah. address them? Because I'll tell you where I'm coming from. It's not only about, I can understand the cultural aspects, but I personally think women are just much more efficient in work, right? they just have so much more.
Yeah, and that's backed up by research. You're absolutely right. I mean,
how do I convince more women to come into the workforce and get there, right? Because I'm telling you, this is one of the biggest gaps that I see, saying that
yeah,
women have managed so many things,
no.
yet they're not getting the opportunities.
No, that's right. And the statistics are really quite somber and very sobering, unfortunately. I can talk more authoritatively about the EU because that's kind of where I'm based. I mean, ASMR is in Amsterdam. And I'll share with you some statistics which come from Eurostat, which is a very authoritative source. It collects all sorts of statistics across a number of metrics. But in the European Union, only 22% of tech roles are occupied by women.
Wow.
Only 22, only a fifth. I mean, that's appalling. And in the Netherlands, where I'm based, it's actually only 18%.
Really?
Yeah. And I mean, in the UK, it's about 20%. Now, we look at the figures globally, and I got some figures from the UN, which show that 25% of women in technology firms are women, 25% globally. And of AI professionals, again, it's only about a fifth are women globally. And then we look at leadership, and the statistics get even more depressing, unfortunately.
Right.
If we look at global statistics across tech companies, only 17% of women are in leadership roles. So something's not right there. And then I thought, well, let's take a deep dive into specific roles that women are doing in tech. And I found some stats again in the European context. And again, it just happens to be we have more data for Europe than we do globally. You can imagine just how difficult it is to map this across many thousands and thousands of companies, but in the EU, they're pretty good at doing that. And you find that even within that 22% I mentioned earlier of women in tech roles, when we look at job roles, what you find is that women are more heavily concentrated in things like product design and management. So, for example, 46% of women and 46% of roles in product design and management are women, 54% are men. And then you look at data engineering and data science, there you find that 30% are women, 70% are men. So still more men, but you find more women in those particular job roles. But then you look at things like cloud engineering, and there only 8 to 10% are women. And now these are the ones that are the high end, highly specialized, highly paid roles. Only 8 to 10% are women. Now that's not right. Something's not right there. And, you know, a lot of research shows that not only do we need to invest in women to plug acute skill gaps in tech, because companies are really struggling to fill these job roles, and particularly in Europe, because, of course, you'll know, being based in India and the US, we're having to source a lot of these skill sets from overseas. But the other thing to say is it is actually economically advantageous for companies and economies to have more women. Mm-hmm. More women in leadership equals better profit. I mean, you know, the research shows this. I'm not just making this up. There's plenty of research to show this. And one example of research is a study that's done by Credit Suisse, where they do this survey, and they do this every few years. The last one was in 2019, where they surveyed 30,000 senior executives across 3,000 companies. And that was across 56 companies. So it was a big study to look at women in senior leadership. And what it found is generally about 17% of these companies had women in senior management positions. And then it looked at the economic growth of these companies, and it tracked them across a number of financial metrics like share price, EBITDA, return on capital. And it tracked these businesses over time. And it found a really significant thing, which it describes as this sort of premium, this sort of diversity premium. They describe it as a diversity premium. Companies that had, really interesting, companies that had 30% or more women in senior management outperformed those that had fewer.
Wow.
And it seemed to be that you had to get at least 30% for that company to really see this significant financial difference. Companies that had fewer than that, particularly companies that had only 10% or less, were worse off financially. You know, their profit margins, their share price, all would be going down over the period in which this study was done, which is fascinating, absolutely fascinating. So although we can't ever prove a causal relationship, I think there is a strong correlation of this economic imperative. Why might that be? Why might companies do better financially having more women? I think it just goes back to this issue around diversity. We need to bring in diversity of views in decision making. And it's not just women, we need to bring diversity of views from all sorts of other areas, you know, other underrepresented groups like marginalized ethnic minorities, for example. Mm-hmm. But women, I think perhaps because they've experienced greater hardship, this is my theory anyway, that they've experienced greater hardship in rising to senior leadership, is that they're more pragmatic, and I think they're more grounded. And that is important for companies when they're looking to grow. You know, that sort of pragmatism is really important when you're making really serious decisions, really tough decisions about restructuring or making very tough decisions about, you know, mergers and acquisitions. I think women, from that experience that they bring, provide something quite different that perhaps men don't, because they've not had the same experiences that women have. That's my theory anyway. And you just don't take my word for it. McKinsey did a study, again, in looking at Europe, and it found that if we doubled the share of women in the tech workforce just by 2027, so not long, I mean, you know, just a few, 5 years or so away, we could increase GDP from the current tech contribution of 260 billion euros to 600 billion euros. Yeah, I mean, isn't that amazing? I mean, that's a study by McKinsey, and I think that's a pretty authoritative source. So there are a lot of really good reasons why we should be encouraging more women, not just because it's the right moral thing to do, but it makes financial sense as well.
Right. So do you have sort of any thoughts, tips, et cetera, that organizations can sort of enact to encourage more women in the tech space and in the cloud space, for example, or in more niche areas? I mean, I'm sure you've seen it all, but what are the easy things that organizations can do to just encourage women? Or maybe it's an organizational thing where the leadership needs to look at things first. I mean, love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, if it was easy, we would have solved this problem, right? I mean, the fact that we're still talking about this now is quite astonishing, given that, you know, we've had women's rights for such a long time, and most countries have really good legislation to enforce equality in the workplace. You know, why are we still talking about it? There are a lot of different things. Where do we start? Well, one of the frustrations that women, you know, have in very male-dominated environments is they just feel that they're not being taken as seriously, and they're not heard, and they're not seen. And sometimes, you know, Sunak, it feels like no matter how hard you work, you end up getting passed over for promotion. You know, you find your male peers are earning more than you do. And it almost feels like no matter what you do, you're still going to get criticized in some way or the other. And again, research backs this up. And the way that I've tackled that on a very personal level is I've just had to work much harder. I mean, I've always felt like I've had to work three times as hard as my male peers to get where I am. And obviously that takes a strain on one, particularly your family life, but that is what us women have to do. We have to work a lot harder.
Right.
We have to work really hard to be visible. You know, we have to show up in all the right places, and we have to make the connections with the right people. And that's bloody hard work. It really is. But it is necessary, and that's what we have to do when companies are not making it easy for women. You know, companies do need to make, you know, they need to foster these more enabling environments that women can flourish. And there are a lot of different things that they need to do for that to happen. We can talk about those very specific things, if you like. Is that what you're alluding to? Would you like me to talk about some very specific things that companies
can do? Oh, absolutely. I would love to get some specific examples if you have it. I mean, I know in general, there's a lot of things that need to be done, but I think you know, if you have to chip away one thing at a time, what could some of those things be?
Well, first of all, let me say, and I say this always, this isn't a problem that women created. You know, that their lack of diversity isn't because women have a problem. It's nothing to do with women. It's the processes, it's the culture, it's the systemic, you know, problems that we experience in society more broadly. I think I should be really clear, because there's always a risk that somehow we bring this down to identity politics. You know, it's all about women. We need to make women more confident. We need to give women mentorship programs, you know, and then they will rise. And that's not enough. But these things still are needed. So let's deal with the tactical things that we can do, the practical things that we can still do in the workplace. We absolutely need mentoring and sponsorship, you know, even though sometimes that kind of feels tokenistic, it is still a requirement. Mm-hmm. But we need the leadership to really champion it. They need to really be the sponsors of these initiatives and take time to be the mentors, and, you know, not pass the buck to somebody else to do. And I think, you know, they need to model the kind of behaviors that encourage women. So they need to be vulnerable. You know, they need to be open about failures that they've made. They need to be honest about how tough leadership is. And they need to actively open doors for women. So mentoring and sponsorship is still really important. And I think sponsorship for men is particularly important for women. We need to have more male allies, given that men already in positions of power in the workplace, right, they need to help us rise. There's always things like implicit bias training. Sure, these things are helpful, but not as a one-off. You know, I really find it so frustrating when a company just does this like 1 day or 2 day workshop where all the leadership go on diversity training as though that's going to solve the problem. Right. I mean, how tokenistic can you get, right? These things have to be embedded in everyday behaviors. We need to always be thinking about being self-aware about things. You know, when we're judging a person, we need to think like, well, will we behave the same way if that person was a man? Mm-hmm. Are we treating this person differently because they're a woman? We need to always be challenging our assumptions constantly, and that kind of training needs to be regular. You know, it's not a one-off thing. It needs to be provided all the time. And just having more women role models is really important. There is like this aphorism that we often use, don't we? You cannot be what you cannot see. That's so true. I think representation really matters. So simply champion women and making them visible in your organization, really having their back and supporting mm-hmm. them. Women down the ranks, when they see that, it really inspires them. If they can see their female leaders being promoted and being supported, then it gives them hope that they can have that for themselves as well. But it right. isn't an instant fix. You right. know, these things take a lot of time, and I think it really goes back to leadership and leadership education. I think companies need to really look at their values, first of all, and be really brave and bold. And if they say that they believe in diversity, equity and inclusion, that they really mean it and they can prove it. It's no point, Sunak, having a wonderful value statement on your website. Right. You know, this really great corporate mission and vision and value statement, and then you don't actually behave in that way. I think companies that do that need to be called out. But, you know, they need to be looking at their hiring strategies.
Right.
You know, they need to be having, you know, diversity on their hiring panels. They need to be actively going and looking for women and underprivileged communities and actively engaging with schools, for example, to develop that kind of outreach, but also to provide the work experience and the mentorship for the future talent pipeline, you know, these future talent leaders, and actively work with universities and colleges. And the other thing, of course, is flexible working. I mean, I think more companies are now very accustomed to that given the pandemic. But doesn't it frustrate you? It certainly frustrates me that it took a pandemic for us to realize that actual flexible working is really important, and that work-life balance is really important. And actually, flexible working can be as productive, if not more productive, for your workplace. So all these things are important. There's not just, you know, one tactic. It's right. it's the sum of all these parts that can really drive meaningful change.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think sort of as you indicated, it really is a top-down approach that one needs to take as an organization. So no, you're absolutely right. I do want to touch on one more topic/point before I let you go. How do you sort of overcome culture? And what I mean by culture is I mean the macro culture. So I'll give you an example, right? You know, we do a lot of work with sort of schools, and the whole you know, trying to empower the girl child, etc., all that kind of stuff. And you know, I was sort of mentoring a couple of girls you know, in one of the sort of the municipal schools, and there was this one girl who, she was super bright, you know, and you know, you could tell that she could have a great future, etc. And you know, I remember we were working on how to help her open up a bank account. And then, you know, right, you know, it was an English thing, and she, you know, she figured out how to do it, etc. She even went and got the account open. But when I went sort of a week later or 2 weeks later after that, she wasn't there anymore. So I find out what happened, and she had been called back to her village because she was 14 and she's the marriageable age, and she had to get married, and that was the end of that. And I'm like,
wow.
Like, wow. I mean, we just wasted something that you could tell could have become something. So how do we, you know, I know it's a very, very rhetorical question, but how do we overcome culture?
Yeah, no, it is. And it's not a question that I can answer in a few minutes. I mean, this is a discourse in its own right.
Yeah, so, yes,
But you're absolutely right. And it does obviously differ from society to society, but there are some common patterns that we see. One is that there are these drop-offs that we see within a woman's career trajectory in tech. And it's possibly true in other industries, but particularly in tech.
Mm-hmm.
And the first drop-off that we see is in those very, very early years, like this young 14-year-old you mentioned, but younger, back at school. You know, we just don't get girls excited about computer science and maths, you know, but we're just not encouraging girls to get into STEM at school at that very, very early age. And what happens is it becomes this negative self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right.
Because we don't actively encourage girls, they then don't show any interest. They don't then show any interest. We then think we're not going to actively encourage them. What's the point, right? And so we then focus on the boys because they're the ones that are showing active interest in computer science. And we think, well, they should go on to high, you know, to college and study this and develop a career in it. So how do we deal with that? And that is really all about making maths and tech fun at a really, really early age and having things like coding clubs. And I'm really so delighted to see so many of these coding clubs spring up all over the place these days. And you know, actively encourage girls to get involved in them and dispel this idea that girls are not interested in these types of subjects. Across Europe, and I'm sure this is global, girls actually outperform boys in things like maths and pure sciences in school. You know, up to the age of 15, 16, they actually outperform boys. But then boys then accelerate and then go on to develop competencies and careers in this area, that and women don't. So that's really fascinating and troubling at the same time. So that really early age is really important. And that's not the girls, it's about the teachers, it's about their parents, it's about the community, their uncles and aunts. Everybody needs to take responsibility in actively encouraging girls in these areas. The second drop-off that we see is in at university stage, mm-hmm. which is really, really interesting and, again, really troubling. And, again, I can only use the European example because we simply have more research in this area. But what we find is, and this is really troubling, of the women that go on to do STEM, let's say they're doing like economics or they do physics. Of those women, and 56% of STEM graduates, you know, are actually women. But of those, only like 23% actually then go on to have a career in tech.
Really? I mean,
why is that happening? It doesn't make sense.
Right.
It doesn't make sense. So we got to understand, like, something is then putting those young women off actually pursuing a career in tech.
Right.
So this is where the tech companies have a real responsibility to go into the colleges, to go into the universities and provide work experience, for example, to encourage these young women to come into their workplace and like do office tours, meet the women in their workplace so that they feel inspired by these women and feel like, yeah, maybe I should go into tech. Something is putting them off. What is that? Maybe they feel it's not for them and something makes them change their mind. So that's another drop-off point. And then the other drop-off point is actually once women are in tech. And again, some really worrying statistics in the UK. And this is really troubling. 50% of young women under the age of 35, you know, leave their tech job by the time they get to 35. 50% leave by the time they get to 35. I mean, that's just astonishing. What is putting them off? What is putting them off? Well, they asked them, what is putting you off? And they told us, you know, what's putting them off is often they don't feel supported in the tech roles. They feel there's a very macho culture. It's often not very flexible. And we have heard about the rise of the so-called bro and frat boy culture emerge more in the tech space recently, you know, more in the sort of startup space, I would say, mm-hmm. rather in the established big tech companies, but maybe it's there as well. And I'm sure you're aware of some of those high profile cases of sexual harassment that has hit the headlines recently. But women are not feeling supported. And I spoke to a young woman recently who joined a very tech analytics business. And she said, you know, I go into work and it's full of gaming consoles and it's everybody goes to the bar after work, but I've got a young family I need to support. Right. I can't go to the bar after work. I have to go home and pick up my kids and make their dinner, you know, and I don't want to be playing game consoles when I'm at work. I've got a serious job to do. And it almost feels like she feels she needs to be the adult in the room. And she's almost feeling like she's taken on this mothering type of persona,
right.
which she doesn't want to do because, you know, that's not her job to be right. the mother to these, you know, to these young men that she finds quite obnoxious. So something is happening that is really putting women off. So we really need to look at that soon. I certainly don't have the answers. But at the same time, I don't want to leave feeling pessimistic about the future. I want to leave feeling hopeful. And because I'm a kind of, you know, hopeful kind of person, I always look at the bright side of life. And I actually do think things are changing. I think, first of all, women are calling things out. I think women are taking ownership for things a lot more. They're saying, look, I want to grow in my career. Can you help me? And they're actively seeking out practical things that they can do, like mentorship, like sponsorship, which is actually quite different to when I started my career, where you would never do something like that. That would be a sign of weakness.
Right.
You went to your senior leaders and you said, hey, I'm really struggling. I need a bit of help. I need a bit of mentoring. I think people would have looked down on you like, well, she's obviously not smart enough. She's not capable enough. I think now women are feeling confident enough to say, I need help and I need your support. You can really help me to rise. Will you help me to rise? And they're actually going out and asking their leaders for help. And I think that's a really positive thing. And I encourage more women to be brave and to do that, because that, I think, will really accelerate change.
Awesome. Awesome. Fascinating. Thank you so much. I mean, I can...
You're very welcome.
I can easily talk for another hour, two, probably days. But
well, it's a complex and challenging topic, and I think it warrants a lot more debate.
Oh, so most certainly. And I think... women like you have made immense strides, and I know it's just, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it may feel like just a drop in the bucket, but you know, you're definitely a role model, and people, someone to look up to. And I would definitely encourage not only our women listener, but the listeners, but all our listeners to really follow Dr. Khan and really just look at her journey and sort of what she's achieved, and it's something to aspire to. So thank you.
Yeah, do follow me on LinkedIn, and I have a book coming out, Pearson Business Books, on women in leadership, how women rise, and you know, and it does look at some of these issues in terms of the things that are still holding back, and that really the organizational things that we need to do to support women. And just remember that it's not women's fault. They're not the problem here. It's the system, and we need to fix that system. Yeah. Anyway, delighted to speak. Thank you so much. It's been
a real
pleasure.
So much.
Bye. Bye.
Have a great day. Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for joining. And until next time, take care.